This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, Medicaid and Medicare are healing, not hurting.
But now, prison labor, which is every corporation's dream, right? Cheap labor, no sick leave, no time off, no holidays, and employees that can be easily replaced. Of course, for human rights activists, it's a nightmare, because the other side of the coin is forced labor, no unions, low or no pay, and no protections whatsoever for the workers.
Corporations have used or currently use prison labor for everything from holiday coffee for Starbucks to cutting airplane components for Boeing, making Game Boys for Nintendo, producing equipment for the war in Iraq, making dentures, and even sewing lingerie for Victoria's Secret.
The use of slave labor and now the use of prison labor. Well, it's a multi-billion dollar business. To talk with us about corporations' super exploitation of prison labor is independent journalist Rania Kalik, and we welcome you to WBAI.
Thanks for having me on.
How extensive, how pernicious and prevalent is the use by corporations of convict labor?
It's pretty widely used. I mean, you just listed a couple large corporations. You said Starbucks and Microsoft and Victoria's Secret. And, you know, so just about the biggest corporations you can think of have most likely used prison labor for something at some point. So, yeah, it's pretty widespread. Exact numbers are kind of difficult to find, but it is a multi-billion dollar industry in that corporations save lots and lots of money. I mean, it's not just corporations either. It's also the government that uses prison labor as well. There's a government corporation called Unicor that actually uses federal prison labor usually to make weapons or do various things for defense contractors. It's also used by the states more and more, especially recently with the economic downturn. Lots of states are turning to prison labor to try and save money. They're using prison laborers to do things like construction work, pick up trash, just very menial jobs so that they don't have to pay anybody for it so they can save money. So it's a very widespread thing that happens.
And the prisoners, of course, are free to do this if they want to, and if they don't want to, it's fine, and they're getting paid money.
Oh, of course, they're getting paid.
What's the problem?
That would be wonderful, but the bigger problem is that, yeah, it's not necessarily that there should be this huge problem with prisoners working. It's the fact that they have no rights. Some cases, they do have a choice, like whether to work or not work at all, but working, they can actually, in some cases, it takes time off of their sentences. But then if they don't get to pick where they're going to work or what they're going to do. So if they get chosen to do something dangerous and they choose not to do it, then they can actually get more time added onto their sentences. On top of that, there are about 30 states have laws where it's okay for convict labor to be used by private corporations, and their average pay is something like 93 cents to $4 and something per day. In federal prisons, it's a little bit more. It's like 23 cents to $1.25 an hour. So they're getting paid these tiny, tiny wages. This rivals sweatshop wages in third world countries. So, and they don't have the right to organize or unionize. I mean, and if you're a prisoner, you're easily silenced. You don't get to complain. You don't get a sick day. They literally have no rights. This is a captive workforce with no rights and no voice because they're in prison.
For those people who are unsympathetic or unconcerned about who the population is that are in prison and what they've done, let's just humanize these folks to begin with as we continue this discussion of this super exploitation. Who are we talking about?
You know, lots of people think, oh, it's no big deal. You know, prisoners are in jail. We're paying for them to be housed there. We're paying for their food. And, you know, they've committed a crime and now they have to do their time. But lots of people don't realize that because of our very draconian and strict laws, mostly on drug use, about 60% of the U.S. prison population is in jail for nonviolent offenses. They're mostly nonviolent drug offenses. So the prisoner population is not only, you know, it's generally people of color, people from poor communities who are targeted with these very draconian laws that put them in prison for really harmless offenses. So we're not talking about, you know, murderers and rapists, and we want them to, I mean, everybody should have rights, don't get me wrong, but you know, lots of people are obviously not sympathetic to murderers and rapists, but, you know, many of these inmates are people who are in jail for doing something as simple as having marijuana in their pocket, literally. So it's a group of people who have been disenfranchised, who are people of minority who are being forced to work. And it really harkens back to a slavery-type mentality, in my opinion.
When we talk about prisons, I mean, there are some obviously that are run by the federal government and some by states, but they're also contracted out sometimes to private companies.
Do you mean private prisons?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the question, I mean, why don't you talk about the private prisons, but also do the prisons get money from the manufacturers or so on and so forth to promote prison labor? Is there reimbursement to the prisons themselves?
You know, that's an interesting question. I'm not as familiar with those sort of dealings. But I do know that one particular thing that's interesting is that the U.S. government actually subsidizes corporations for using inmate labor. It's like a tax write-off. Specifically, it's called the Work Opportunity Tax Credit, and it basically allows private sector employers to earn something like $2,400 for every work release inmate they employ, as a reward for hiring risky target groups. So they can earn back up to 40% of the wages they pay annually to these prisoners. So that's the most I know when it comes down to how much they can make off of it. But in a way, yes. And I'm sure there's probably dealings as well. I just don't know the specifics of them.
So we're dealing with prisoners who can make anywhere from 23 cents an hour to a dollar 25 cents
yeah.
an hour. But I want you to elaborate on some of the research that you did about the nature or the corporations that were using prison labor. Tell us who some of those corporations are, just to get a sense of how extensive it really is.
So there are some of the ones you had mentioned earlier, in addition to there's Boeing, there's Victoria's Secret, I know JCPenney's has, there's Third Generation and Motorola, and AT&T Wireless has done it, Texas Instruments, Dell, Intel has. I mean, literally every large Target stores have used prison labor. Everything that you can, like every corporation that you can think of has probably used prison labor at some point. I mean, it's very, very widespread. And a lot of times the people you're speaking to on the phone, telemarketers, are prison laborers, which is something else that's kind of interesting. But one thing that's interesting is when you look deeper into it, I mean, there's been some really egregious cases. For example, BP, after the Deepwater Horizon exploded, that killed the 11 workers, and, you know, the Gulf of Mexico had oil just erupting into it for weeks. During the cleanup, BP actually hired prison inmates from Louisiana to clean up the mess. And people were in the communities and the surrounding communities were outraged at the time because they had basically lost their livelihoods because of this oil spill. Those were jobs that they really needed at the time. And so rather than BP instead using the people in the community, actually paying them to do the cleanup, they just changed the clothes of the prison laborers. So they tried to, like, hide the fact that they were using prison labor. That's one example where, that was outrageous. It did not get, you know, talked about enough in the media. Well, in some cases, some corporations have actually gotten up and moved their factories from one place to another. For example, I know that there was this one corporation I mentioned, Escott Industries, which in the 1990s actually abandoned plans to open operations in Mexico and instead moved to South Carolina because the wages of American prisoners undercut those of the deunionized Mexican sweatshop workers. So this is a case where the government of the state actually said, hey, wait, stay here, you could use our prison laborers. And they didn't go to a third world country to do it. So it's very, very widespread.
I believe you had a section in your article in which you were saying that with the fiscal crisis now, that many state governments are replacing public employees with prison labor.
Yeah, that is true. And this happened most recently. It got, you know, it had a little bit of an uproar behind it in Wisconsin because of Governor Scott Walker's anti-union law that went through. There's one town where prisoners are now taking up the jobs that were once held by unionized workers. I think it was a construction job these are very menial jobs generally. I mean, these aren't very high paying jobs, but at the same time, it just like in any situation where workers are losing their rights, I mean, prison laborers, when they become widely available, it really brings down all workers' rights in a sense. So in this case, unionized workers are replaced for free labor. And this is happening in various states around the country where states are enlisting prison laborers to close budget gaps because they, you know, they're struggling with these huge deficits. For example, I know in New Jersey, there's like inmates being used for roadkill patrol or something along those lines.
And I have to point out that Borough President Marty Markowitz in Brooklyn has used prison labor to clean up after his concerts, etc., trying to claim that there's some sort of rehabilitative function to using people as garbage collectors, not to mention the fact that they also were replacing workers that used to work in the Parks Department. So it's right in our backyard and in front of our own noses. And you even have a more egregious one where a GOP congressional candidate,
yes,
Jack Metcalf, hired Washington State prisoners to do what?
Yeah, I mean, this actually, I was shocked by this. I mean, it happened a while ago, so it's, I mean, I wasn't surprised that I didn't know about it, but I was still shocked. So a candidate running for office actually used, it was a GOP congressional candidate, he hired Washington State prisoners to call and remind potential voters that he was pro-death penalty, which, I mean, that's a really sick example, but yeah, I mean, this is a case where a politician used private prison labor for his own personal benefit.
But I want to push it even further, because what you mentioned, which begins to really institutionalize this, well, that example's insult to injury, you had Senator John Ensign, who introduced a bill earlier this year to require all low-security prisoners to work 50 hours a week.
Yeah, that's something that's been he's kind of been at the forefront. He's always, since he came into office, he's been wanting to expand prison labor and force prison labor. I mean, at least in this case, most times someone can actually choose whether they just want to sit around all day in a cell or work. But yeah, in this case, it would force all prisoners to work more than the 40 hours, work a 50-hour work week. I mean, if that's not a form of slavery, I'm really not sure what is. But yeah, it's disgusting. And I mean, I'm not sure I assume John Ensign probably received some kind of monetary donations from the prison industry, which probably happens in a lot of cases. So there's kind of that aspect to it too, is how much are these prison industries influencing these types of decisions?
So what can be done about this? I mean, at one point you even go so far as to say that the prisoners should be able to form unions. What else can be done?
There's a lot to be said about reforming the prison labor system, but I think the most important thing is to really reform the criminal justice system. That should kind of be the overall goal, because the reason so many people are in jail, I mean, we have 5% of the world's population in the U.S., but we make up 25% of the world's prisoners. We imprison a lot of people, and a lot of profit is made off of this. I think what needs to be done is that we really need to reform these outrageous draconian laws that put people in prison for, you know, these minimum sentencing laws and these three strike laws that put people in prison for ridiculous amounts of time for really harmless crimes that really shouldn't even be considered crimes. But on top of that, in terms of prison labor, yes, allowing workers to unionize would be one great way to go about it, because at least there would be some leverage in that case, because right now you have a system where this captive workforce that's already so disenfranchised and has no rights whatsoever, that giving them some leverage and saying, like, we demand at least to have a safe work environment, and we demand to at least be paid some money. I mean, they shouldn't be working for free, and we demand to have a choice in where we work and what we do and if we want to work would be one good way to go about it. And there was actually the prisoner strikes earlier in the
Georgia.
Year. Yeah, in Georgia, where that's what these prisoners were demanding, you know, all these really common human rights that workers should have or are supposed to have. They were demanding to have these rights. And then, I mean, they're invisible, literally invisible. I mean, nobody sees prisoners on the streets protesting with signs. They're locked up. So anybody who's interested can always add their voice to the mix, because people on the outside of prison are definitely helpful in that case.
And one of the things, of course, that you point out in your article is a company, Boeing subcontractor, Microjet, had prisoners cutting airplane components, paying them $7 an hour for the work that paid union wages theretofore were $30,
right,
on the outside. So we really have miles to go, and we'll continue to explore this issue. What I'd like to know, first and foremost, is where can people get your article? Because we didn't even go through the historic dimensions and contextualize this, which we have to do. Where can people see your article? Very good, very important article.
Well, thank you. People can read it at alternet.org, which is where I'm a writer. So I'm an associate writer at Alternet. So, yeah, you can find my articles there, and this is definitely one of them. It's called 21st Century Slaves, How Corporations Exploit Prison Labor. Thank you for covering it. It really doesn't get the attention it deserves.
It certainly doesn't. We're talking about one of every 48 working age men that are behind bars in this country. Well, we have been speaking with independent journalist Rania Kalik, and we're going to have her back to continue to look at this issue. Both Democrats and Republicans, they're missing the point by putting the emphasis on controlling Medicare and Medicaid costs without effectively addressing the reasons for our rising health care costs. Rather than embracing the Republican rhetoric which blames our public insurance, Democrats would do well to call out the real reason for our health care spending crisis, our current fragmented and profit-driven model. And advocates for a national improved Medicare for all know that.
Watching the rhetoric on each issue in Washington is like watching reruns. The crisis, manufactured or real, becomes an excuse to move towards greater austerity measures for necessities such as health care, Social Security, and other entitlement programs. We must examine the root causes of our economic dilemma and devise plans to address them. With us is Dr. Margaret Flowers with Physicians for a National Health Program and Sarah Somers, Senior Attorney with the National Health Law Program.
Hello.
Sarah, why don't we begin just for those who have not yet had the experience of needing Medicaid or Medicare, explain what they are and their incredible vitality to public health.
The Medicare program is a publicly funded insurance program for people over the age of 65 and some limited categories of people with disabilities. It's a completely federally funded program, but many of the providers in the Medicare system, of course, are private providers, doctors and hospitals. Medicaid, on the other hand, is a public insurance program that covers low-income people. And Medicaid, unlike Medicare, is a cooperative federal and state program. The administration is shared by the federal government and individual state government. What's more, the federal government matches state health expenditure. And Medicaid covers certain categories of low-income people, including children, their caretakers, people with disabilities, and very low-income Medicare beneficiaries who can't afford to pay the Medicare premium. And both of these programs are an incredibly, you know, a very large part of our healthcare system. Our organization focuses particularly on Medicaid, and Medicaid covers almost 60 million people who have a limited ability to pay for their health care. And Medicaid is an important part of the Affordable Care Act. Right now, limited categories of people are covered by Medicaid, but starting in 2014, everybody, with some limited exceptions, with incomes under 133% of the federal poverty level, are going to be eligible for Medicaid. That's about $30,000 for a family of four. And Medicaid, like Medicare, operates through a system of private providers who are reimbursed by the combination of federal and state funds. So it's not correct when people talk about these as being completely national health care programs or socialized medicine. They're a combination of public and private partnerships. And the federal law for Medicaid imposes a sort of a skeleton of what the states have to cover and imposes certain requirements on the state. And within those boundaries, they're allowed a great deal of flexibility in the populations and services that they cover. About 60 million people, as I said, are covered by Medicaid, and starting in 2014, that'll add another 9 million. And it's very important to emphasize that Medicaid is the biggest payer for long-term care services, including nursing home and other institutional services, as well as community-based services for elderly people and people with disabilities. And that is a big-ticket, expensive health care item. And both the private insurance industry and Medicare do not cover for this type of care only in very limited circumstances. Long-term care insurance is incredibly expensive on the private market. So Medicaid is shouldering the most expensive and the heaviest burden of the health care system. So it's simply not correct when you hear critics of the program complain that it has skyrocketing costs that are completely unreasonable because it's a poorly managed program. First of all, the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured issued a study earlier this year which showed that actually per capita spending increases in Medicaid have been far below that of private insurance payers. And even if Medicaid does require a lot of spending, that's because these are the most expensive, sickest people in the population. And so beating up on Medicaid as a scapegoat for the problems with our health care system is completely wrongheaded.
Well, there has been a lot of beating up on Medicaid and also recently Medicare. And Dr. Flowers, you're saying that this we're asking the wrong question, that we're talking about cutbacks in Medicare and Medicaid when they're not the problem. So do you want to take it from there?
Certainly, absolutely. I think people point to, in the federal government, point to the rising cost of care under Medicare. But the reason that the costs of care are rising is that we have a situation in this country in which we don't have a health system, and so we don't have a way to effectively control our health care costs. And that causes the price to rise for all parts of the system, including Medicare. But Medicare is actually one of our most efficient parts of health care in this country. Its administrative costs are a tenth of what we see in the privately financed portion of our health care. And so the best solution is not to take the most efficient part of our health care system and cut it back, but to actually expand that. If we created a national improved Medicare for all, which would be a universal health care system so that everybody in the country would have access to care without worrying about whether they can afford to pay for it, we can actually effectively control our health care costs, control the cost of pharmaceuticals so that we're not paying the most in the world for the same medications, and we would be able to cover everybody in this country for about the same amount of money that we're currently spending and provide high-quality comprehensive care. So we're saying, you know, don't cut Medicare, improve it and expand it to everybody in the country.
Sarah?
I think that you know, that's absolutely consistent with what the research shows about the efficiency of these publicly funded programs. But I really want to emphasize for your listeners that there are serious threats that they need to watch out for and be mindful that they should be calling their representatives to fight cuts that are certain to be proposed to both of these programs. Probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with the standoff over the debt ceiling. And in reaction to resolve this standoff, the Budget Control Act was passed, which immediately imposes reductions in spending of over $1 trillion over the next decade. In addition, there's going to be a super committee of 12 legislators that are supposed to meet and come up with an additional $1.5 trillion in spending cuts over the next decade. In the first round of reductions, Medicare and Medicaid are exempted from this. If the super committee fails, there will be automatic cuts to spending that exempt Medicaid but do affect Medicare provider rates, which can also increase access for beneficiaries. But the actions of the super committee, which are supposed to find these savings, they have a lot of power. They have power to cut Medicare and Medicaid. They have power to restructure the Medicaid program into a program that wouldn't be an entitlement, for example, that would look nothing like the program that so many people have come to rely on. So people should pay close attention and make sure that at every opportunity they remind their legislators not to dismantle these programs and not to disrupt them, but to keep them as vital as they are and not be penny-wise and pound-foolish.
Dr. Flowers, the paradigm seems to be cutting right now and how to resist the cuts. And how do we turn this around so that we can get a more efficient solution, which is Medicare for all or single payer?
Right. Well, you're correct. I mean, the trends that we're seeing are very disturbing. You know, we've seen this kind of march towards cutting our Medicare and Medicaid and positioning Congress so that it's able to do that. And even now the president is supporting cuts to our important social insurances. What we found during the health reform process is many other people who advocate for issues of economic justice or social justice find, or, you know, climate or environmental change, things like that, find is that the policies that come out of D.C. are not in large part derived from the evidence of what works, but there's heavy influence by the corporations who profit off of our current situation. And so we see healthcare as part of the broader movement for economic and social justice in this country, for, you know, jobs and education and ending foreclosures. And so part of our work at this point really needs to be moving beyond our traditional tools of advocacy, which are lobbying and emailing and trying to elect somebody who supports our position, but really joining our efforts together to put some pressure on Congress to actually cause them to move in the direction of meeting our human needs. And so you may be aware that one of my biggest projects right now is actually called October2011.org, and this is bringing together leaders and advocates from these various movements, and we will be beginning with an occupation of Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. in October, around the time that the new federal budget will be kicking in, which allows unlimited spending for war, but cutting back on our human services.
And, Sarah, what are you going to be doing in October, aside from your sentiments being with Dr. Flowers?
Well, at the National Health Law Program, we are committed to fighting through the traditional means to ensure that the greatest extent possible that Medicaid and Medicare programs are protected from these cuts. We also are part of a network not just of federally based organizations, but we are connected with advocates in all of the 50 states who work on Medicaid issues and to assist them in their fights at the local level as well.
And we'll have to pay close attention to what's happening in Vermont, where the state wants to buy health care services for the entire population, and they believe they can negotiate favorable rates and eliminate the mass overhead of the for-profit insurers. So we've got a lot of work to do, but one thing is absolutely clear. We must wind up with the Medicare for all, but we must save Medicaid and hold the fort. And we have been speaking with Sarah Somers, who is a senior attorney with the National Health Law Program, and Dr. Margaret Flowers with Physicians for a National Health Program. Thank you, sisters, for joining us. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.